The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD and UD Information Technologies present Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon, manager of the IT Communication Group at the University of Delaware.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us today on Campus Voices, we have Professor Matt Oliver from the Lewis Campus, from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment, from the School of Marine Sciences and Policy. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thank you.
The first thing I want to ask you is, people think of marine biology and marine oceanography. What is the difference between all those different kinds of subjects?
Well, you're right. There's a sense in which people think about marine biology and oceanography as being maybe somewhat interchangeable. There are many, many similarities between the two, but if you're going to get particular about it, marine biology tends to, although not always, tends to focus on the organism. And so you're looking at physiological responses, understanding the DNA, understanding gene expression, whereas, say, biological oceanography looks much more at the interface between the physical environment and the organism itself. And we tend not to be as focused on the organism per se, and much more focused on how the physical forces of the environment sort of shape the ecosystem and determine where specific organisms live.
So you do things like, say, okay, if the water temperature is such and so, then the fish will go here, the fish will go there, that kind of thing.
That's exactly it. So we're sort of one level up, and of course we like to work with the marine biologists a lot because how much we know about the organism certainly is that missing component for understanding how it is that they're going to be operating in the environment. And so we tend to work on that interface in between physical measurements from satellites or underwater robotics or buoys or things of that nature and some intuitive understanding or some deep understanding about the organisms to try and find out what those distributions are.
So I imagine you're starting to see some things where changes in water temperature are leading to changes in spawning patterns in different fish.
People have noticed that. In the systems that we're looking at, say, here in the Mid-Atlantic, we have some hints that maybe migration patterns might actually be different for a few of the different species in related to ocean temperature. Of course, these are things that we're investigating, whether it's temperature per se or something that's highly correlated to temperature. That's something that remains to be seen. But just today, the New York Times came out highlighting a study from the AAAS talking about some of these potential impacts from climate change. So one of the things they talk about is what's called phenology, or the timing of biological events, the timing of a migration or a timing of a spawning or something along those lines. It seems to be highly related to geophysical things that we can measure, temperature, where the moon is, things of that nature.
Salinity.
Where
a certain current is happening to run at this time of year.
That's right. And that is all bound up with not only sort of the regular planetary waves that we think about, things like El Niño, La Niña, tides, but also perturbations to those waves, which we would consider to be climate change. That's really what we're talking about.
It's really a very complex environment that you're studying, isn't it?
It is. And what that means is that when we're looking at particular records, always what it is that we're trying to do is detect trends over cycles and asking ourselves, what are the appropriate tests to see whether or not changes that we're seeing are cyclical in nature or whether or not they represent something new that we haven't seen before. And if they're new and something we haven't seen before, that makes us look for new particular causes of what might be driving these particular changes.
What a lot of people know is that from articles about you in New Daily and that kind of thing, that you're spending a lot of time collaborating with a professor at Delaware State University looking at everybody's favorite creature, sharks.
That's right. We've got a very good working relationship and friendship with a lab at Delaware State University. The lead professor there is Dr. Dwayne Fox. He's been studying, among other things, one of the species he's been studying also. Actually, I should mention, it's in collaboration with another professor at the University of Rhode Island, Brad Weatherby. And they've been looking at, and now us too by extension, have been looking at the sand tiger shark, which is considered to be a top predator in Delaware Bay.
What kinds of things have you been doing with these sand tiger sharks?
Well,
do you capture them and tag them, or are you just like observing them or with robots, or what's going on?
They have been working on sand tiger sharks on actual mark and recapture and also transmitter implantation. Basically, what we're saying is you put an acoustic transmitter, put it into the shark, and then it's beeping underwater, more or less, at a certain frequency. And then they swim around the bay and out in the ocean, and they swim by these acoustic gates or these listening devices, and you can detect where particular sharks are going and why they might be going there.
So these are attached to buoys or
these are
something
attached
like
to
that.
Buoys, that's right. And so how our lab, UD, has gotten involved with that is to add an additional technology, which is putting these listening platforms on underwater robots. And these underwater robots, they're called gliders, can go in and not just measure the detections from the fish, but also all the environmental parameters, temperature, salinity, optics, oxygen, things of that nature that we think might be driving sand tiger distribution. And so as we're out there in the coastal ocean trying to ask the question, not are they migrating or not, but are there particular corridors that they're using? And that turns out to be a really important question if you have multiple users of the ocean. If we're seeking to protect these species, can we come up with a set of parameters or a set of environmental conditions that are favorable or unfavorable and avoid them if we're trying to protect these species? So this is one of the things that our students are working on, looking at these fine scale, what we call habitat associations.
Can the listening devices on these buoys and gliders, can they determine, oh, this is shark 197, or do they just listen for, oh, I hear this many sharks?
They can do both, right? And so, yes, you can get, whenever we capture a shark, we do various analysis on it, length, width. What else did we do? We take genetic samples. You know that shark, right? You know where that shark has been, what that shark has done. You know the sex of the shark, and so when you start asking questions about how these sharks are using the environment, you can say, well, is it male sharks that are just doing this? Is it female sharks that are just doing this? Is it just big sharks that are doing this? And so we're trying to parse that out, you know, instead of just saying sharks in general. Is there some other feature of the shark that seems to be predictive of how they're using the environment?
I think what's really cool about these gliders is you're not just getting the count of the sharks or finding the sharks, but you're picking up salinity, temperature of the water, and other kinds of factors to help you see. Right now, I heard 36 sharks under these conditions.
That's right. And that's the key, right? So that's where we're making the link from marine biology to biological oceanography. The glider is that technological link to actually get us to make that association between what the organisms are doing and where they are with the temperature and salinity. And that, if we just know that, that tells us a lot about what sort of regime is this? Is this, what kind of currents are these that these things are occupying? Are they tied to anything particular on the bottom of the ocean? One thing that one of my students has been looking at, Danielle Halsey, is whether or not these sharks are sensing actually something rather new that we didn't think before. Usually people think temperature and salinity. It could be, if her results hold and we're still testing them, that it's actually an optical property in the water that these things are actually keying off of.
Whether or not they can see through the water, or
actually it's sensing something that's called, that we have a name for, it's called colored dissolved organic material. And it's one thing that the glider can measure using fluorescence. So what we do is we send out a few photons and we look for the fluorescent return from this particular type of compound. And really what CDOM is kind of undifferentiated organic material. And the way to think about it is, if you've ever drank tea, the staining color in the tea is the way to think about CDOM. It's the way that the water is stained. And if you've spent any time on the beach, you can see that the estuaries have sort of this different color. Well, that staining not only happens as stuff washes off the land, but as stuff decomposes from the bottom, you get this sort of material coming up off the bottom. And so it's possible that these sharks are sensing these organic materials, which we don't have access to measure besides having a glider in the water like this. And so it's pointing in a very interesting direction to understand how these how these organisms work. And of course, when you think about sharks, you think, oh, they can smell organic material in the water. Of course, maybe this is the right way to think about what's happening. So the glider really has unlocked, I think, a way to think about what these sharks are doing in a way that we haven't had before.
That's really cool. I mean, because what you're saying is the glider is measuring opacity and sort of responses to light. But then what you're really seeing is it's not really about the color or the opacity, but that's a sign of something else, this organic material that's attracting the sharks.
That's right. And I'll just be clear, we're not sure yet whether or not it's the organic material that's actually attracting the sharks. But again, whether or not their organic material is related to something else that the sharks are actually looking at. And this is part of the feedback loop. When we go out as biological oceanographers and we see something like this, we say, okay, maybe this makes sense. And then we can go back to the marine biologists and say, well, here's an interesting hypothesis for you to test, whether or not this dissolved organic material, you know, does actually induce sensory input to these sharks. And so I think what you see when we make multiple observations, both of the environment and also the sharks themselves, you see this nice feedback loop of science working the way it ought to be working, where you sort of see something you don't expect, and you go back to your colleagues and say, hey, what about this? And so it's actually been a very exciting project.
I think that's fascinating, because what you're really talking about is how, you know, the combination of policy and different kinds of science are all able to work together to refine each other's hypotheses, improve the hypotheses, and actually look for significant things to prove or disprove.
That's right. And one of the hardest things to do in science, I always say, is ask good questions. You have to ask questions that are interesting if they're true or false, not just if they're true. And so this sort of working, you know, back and forth with the marine biologists, and Dwayne and Brad in particular, with what we're seeing in the oceanographic world has been it's been fantastic. It's just been a nice system to look at sharks, which are interesting in general, but also with how they relate to the ocean environment.
Matt, why are sharks so fascinating to so many of us?
That's a fantastic question. And I think that there is something about the shark that is cultural, for sure. When you just look at them, especially the sand tiger shark. The sand tiger shark is one that is often found in aquariums. They have these hunched backs. They have these snaggly-looking teeth sticking out of their mouths. And they look ferocious. And we respond to that in a very visceral way. We just do. And it's hard to say if it's just psychological or if, you know, no, I'm really interested in the function of that shark. That's really what I get at. I think that there's a mixture of responses there that come together. And of course, one of the big things I think in our own culture is that people key off is of course, fear. This is very common to talk to people. You run into this all the time. I'm studying sharks, and they just say, just tell me where they are because I don't want to be anywhere near them. And for good or bad, you know, I think in the community we try to work against that fear to say you really don't have that much to worry about from a sand tiger shark, which is true. They're fish eaters. They're not going to bother you. But at the same time, you can't write off that's just the way people feel about them. And so there's sort of a constant conversation about our perceptions of sharks, why it is that they scare us and people so badly. I mean, if you're in the water and one bumps up next to you, your heart starts racing because you realize that you're no longer at the top of the food web anymore. You've entered into their system. And I think that's a fair thing to say, that that's the case. And so on the one hand, we want people to respect them because they do. They are functional in the environment. But on the other hand, we don't want them to be treated only as functional at the same time, too, as mechanical. We want people to be engaged with them and have a sense of awe with them. I think that is appropriate at some level.
When we talked a couple of weeks ago, that's one of the things you were talking about, is that sense of awe ties in with the whole conservation movement.
Yeah. So what we do is when we look at sharks in the environment, at least one of the things that we do in our lab is we try to deconstruct it, turn it into a set of equations or a set of principles that we can model and predict. And that turns out to be sort of the bread and butter of what we do, you know, for ecology. But I'm a little hesitant to say that when we sort of deconstruct the ecosystems in sharks like that and turn them into a set of equations, that we're capturing the essence of the shark at the same time. So I get a little nervous when people get right to the point and ask, what is their function? To say, well, if we lose them, what does that mean for me, right? And there is a sense, when you look at the conservation literature, you read Rachel Carson or John Muir or pick your one, there's this combined sense of both function and awe, or some response to beauty, that is very, very present in that literature. And the fear that, at least I think you can see in Rachel Carson, is that when students come in to the university and we hammer into them, we're going to reduce it to equation, we're going to reduce it to principle, that we sort of pound out that initial sense of beauty that they have for the environment. In other words, we take students that are, in a sense, motivated by beauty to come into the environment, and when we're done with them, we've made them cynics. And we don't want to do that. We want them to be able to deconstruct an environment into a set of equations to make predictions. That is incredibly important to understand how we as a species are going to interact with the world. But at the same time, if we only say, well, if we only reduce them to function, I feel like that there's something that's being lost.
It's almost like you're saying that there's the danger that if you overanalyze, you'll treat them just like you treat a microbe floating around in the ocean. Here, what's its function, and where does it fit on the food chain?
Yeah, and the analogy I use in this is an experience that I actually had with my daughter. When we went and we got the opportunity to go to France, and we visited the Orangerie, which is where Monet has his water lilies. And she was young, and she got right up close to the painting right away and was standing about a foot away from it. And she just said, this was, you know, I can see all the brush strokes. This is terrible, right? This just looks like chaos. And of course, what is she doing? She's actually standing so close to it. She's deconstructing it so quickly that she's not standing back and seeing it for what the painting is supposed to be. And I think that we can also do that with any really environment, is that we can stand too close, we can deconstruct it, and we can become very cynical about it, and not really sort of capture everything that is really going on, how it is actually really speaking to us. And this, by the way, isn't something that I'm just talking about. I just got back from Ocean Sciences, where we had our lead plenary speaker on Sunday night. She was pointing at this very problem, that we've sort of objectified nature in a way that lets us discard it. And her point was that we needed to actually work against that in a very positive sense. And I was a little wondering about how that was going to go down with 5,000 geophysicists there, you know, because that's our stock and trade. We deconstruct. But at the end of it, she got a standing ovation. And so I think the sentiment that I'm expressing is not a unique one. I think it's held broadly. And I think that's an important thing to think about.
It's almost like you're talking about doctors and their bedside manner. It's not just treating the symptoms, looking at all the blood work, but also talking with the patient and learning how that patient is interacting with the rest of the world.
Yeah, in a sense, right? In a sense. I think, yeah, I do like your analogy there. I think that's a good way to think about it.
Okay. Didn't mean for that to be a showstopper.
Yeah.
Conversation stopper. But really what we're talking about with our guest today is Matt Oliver from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment, and down on the Lewis campus, but we're talking to him on a day when he comes up to Newark. But really what we're talking about is sort of the complexity of the environment, and sharks or wolves or jellyfish, whatever you're looking at, they've got complex roles. And I think sometimes the observer looks at whatever the natural organism is very parochially. You know, I mean, I'm a farmer. I can't have those wolves around. You know, I'm a lifeguard of the beach. I can't have those sharks around.
Right. That you can do that. And I think that what that does, again, I think, especially I think in our modern sort of Western cultures, we're always looking for the function. What do sharks do? Well, of course they do something. They clean up the bay. They're top predators. There's lots of great research to talk about. If you take them out of it, what happens to the ecosystem? You get something that you don't want, right? And so there's that sort of just functional aspect. But if you're really going to be cynical about it, when you look at the world and you ask about the ecosystem sort of on geologic timescales, it's very, very clear that the things that are actually doing the function to make the biogeochemical framework of the world go around are not the sharks and not the wolves and not even really the people. It's the microbes that are doing that. They're the ones that are actually doing the important redox chemistry to make the space, to actually make the environmental space for, when we think about the evolution of sharks or the evolution of wolves or any of those different things. And it hasn't been lost. In fact, I think this just came up. You know, I know that the Cosmos series is going on again. And I was just looking at this, looking at Neil deGrasse Tyson. And he comes out and just says, listen, when you look at the history of the world, as far as back as we can tell, there's been about 5 mass extinctions. And what you find out is something happens, you know, meteor or excess CO2, and the mechanisms are debated, some more than others. But you wipe out all kinds of animal life, plant life. In some sense, they come back almost every time.
The microbes lead the charge.
The microbes lead the charge. And this is an idea that has been out in different variants, either as the Gaia hypothesis, or there's another one that's the Media hypothesis now that Peter Ward has been talking about. And really, it's the microbes that are doing the functional redox chemistry in the interchange with the water and the rock that sort of create this space. And there's a lot of evidence, and I think this is actually coming out in that article I mentioned in the New York Times about climate change, that there's a lot of evidence that we're sort of on our way to a 6th extinction. And we have to come to terms now pretty quickly about what the role of humans are going to be in either aiding and abetting that or preventing it. And this is where really the rubber hits the road in terms of how is it that what we're doing in the college actually goes into policy and gets voted on, really as a reflection of where do we see human beings as interacting with the environment. And there's really, if there are 2 extremes, I could maybe put it in this way. There's a lot of people that will say, the best thing we can do is actually just leave it alone because it will rebound. And it's a view towards the ecosystem that's like a rubber ball. In other words, there's an anthropogenic input, and we sort of press our hand up against this rubber ball, and as soon as it's gone, it rebounds, and it creates its wholeness again. There's another view, which is actually ecosystems aren't like rubber balls at all. They're like silly putty. They kind of bounce, but you can deform them to such a way that you're never going to recover that original shape. And that conception is a little more scary because what it means in some sense that if we want to recover something that we sort of have a nostalgia for, that we're going to have to get into the weeds a bit.
We're going to have to change what's going on.
We're
going
to have to either change what's going on or even there's a buzzword going around now, which is highly debated, which is geoengineering, which is are we at the point where we need to actually really fashion the world the way we want it? And that's hotly debated. That goes along with what are called carbon credits. And that goes along with, you know, I'm going to put carbon over here and I'm going to put it back in the earth in this way. And there's going to be an exchange in that way. And in other words, we're going to regulate. We're going to have some conception of what we want the world to be like. And we're going to tie our regulations around that to that goal. That's what the goal of what our environment is going to be like. And of course, that's all argued over, and you're going to have a different view on that if you're a farmer versus a fisherman versus an artist. I mean, you're going to have really divergent conceptions of what that should be like.
Returning to your domain, the ocean, think of what happened to the codfish. I mean, people knew it was getting overfished, but that didn't stop them.
That's right. There's an interesting phenomena which Garrett Hardin has written about, and it's actually a great... If you're an undergraduate and you're listening to this, go pick up a work by Garrett Hardin called The Tragedy of the Commons. You can find it online. It's free. It's in Science Magazine. Actually, that one's in Science Magazine? I'm not sure. Just look it up and go read the thing. I mean, it's great.
We'll put a link to it.
We'll put a link to it at the
website for this interview.
Yep. Yeah, here's the idea, which is that as long as you have a as long as there's something common, say the ocean is more or less common right now, except for these 200-mile exclusive zones, more or less anything goes out there, right? If you have economic incentive to go out there and get a resource from the ocean, you're going to go get it. And because there's no one out there to basically say, no, you can't do this, or there's no big feedback mechanism to deter you from doing that.
What do your undergraduate students think about all this? I'm asking you because I know that in winter 2014, you helped lead a group to the Cayman Islands where they went to, among other things, look at life on the reefs.
That's right. So my undergraduate interaction has been chiefly with internships. I teach a course here called Mass 42 is Introduction to Ocean Sciences. But you're right, we do have this new course, which is a study abroad in the Cayman Islands. And we're on Little Cayman. And I'm not the only one doing it. There are several other professors that are involved to make it actually, I think, a very outstanding course. Mark Warner, Adam Marsh, Mark Moline, Art Trembanis are all involved in that. And when you go down there to Little Cayman Island, you're on one of the best reefs in the world on this tropical island, and the stars are out, and the beauty is assaulting, right? I mean, there is a visceral impact to it, right? In the same way we were sort of talking about the sharks, is that they go there and have this experience, and they realize that maybe just reducing this down to a set of equations isn't the right way to think about this, you know, or at least the complete way to think about it. And I don't know, it was fun to hear, to see what their responses were. Of course, the Cayman Islands in particular are very, very focused on the value, economic value of the reef, which brings tourists in. But immediately when you ask the question, why is it valuable? It's valuable because it's beautiful. It's just why it is. People are engaged with that level of beauty. It can be sort of this life-altering experience to see stuff like that. I think that was a common experience among the undergraduates.
We've been talking with Matt Oliver, and I think that's a great way to end this interview, because you were just talking about how your undergraduate students learn to put the equations and the modeling that they're learning to do in the classroom into perspective by looking at the beauty of how it all fits together.
That's right.
Thanks very much, Matt.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices, a collaboration between WVUD, the broadcast voice of the University of Delaware, and UD Information Technologies. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD, UD Information Technologies, or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.